Good morning, Canandaigua, and Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the boaters on the lake. Three Men and a Microphone is an opinion show based on the ins and outs, the news, the scuttlebutt, the city, the town, and all the surrounding counties of Canandaigua, New York. Three Men and a Microphone is sponsored by Iron Mike's Military Exchange on Route 332 in Canandaigua. And now, welcome back to our show, and we'll be right back after this brief message with Three Men and a Microphone. Welcome to Canandaigua 1310, Three Men and a Microphone, and I'm your host, Corporal Tim Fortin. And we are here today on WOKR 1310 Radio in Canandaigua, New York. My co-host, Mike Yarger from Canandaigua 2020 Facebook. And our guest co-host is Tina Bloom, and she's going to give us events and entertainment news. And our special guest, Canandaigua Town Deputy Supervisor and former FBI agent, Mr. Keith Kutry. How are you today?
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're all great. You can't say how you're doing.
You can't just look at me. I'm here. Still here. Haven't gone anywhere.
Could you read my eyebrows?
I was waiting to see how long you were going to stare.
I want to throw out there, Tina liked my cartoon of her.
I did.
But I don't think you know that I didn't draw that cartoon.
No, I absolutely did.
You
so, is it from the Archie comic series?
Yes.
Okay. Come on now.
You didn't know.
Well, somebody may have told me. I knew you. It's okay. So I knew you didn't draw it. I mean, you're incredibly artistic, Tim, no doubt. But it looked like me. It was like a spitting image. Spot on. I was born to be, is it Betty or what's
Betty.
Her name? Yeah. Okay.
Betty is the more virtuous one, right?
Right.
Oh, boy. There's a non-virtuous. Then I'm definitely the virtuous one.
Right. So then I got to ask, and am I in trouble for putting that cartoon of the FBI agent? Did you see it?
No, any cartoons, I think, are
you like
freedom of speech.
Okay.
As long as it doesn't hurt anybody, right?
No, no. It was a good one. I don't know. I guess you didn't see it, but I liked it. But I
can only imagine.
You know, the guy with the operator's cap and the sunglasses and the blue windbreaker, you know. That's all it really
that's and
all
the earpiece.
And that's all they gave us. They gave us guns and badges and a blue windbreaker. It was a nylon jacket with yellow letters.
And turn you loose.
And as soon as you leave the service, you have to turn it in for the next guy.
Right, you got to save it for the next guy.
That's right. That's a true story.
So we're here today, and we're going to talk about, of course, Canandaigua local news, but we're also going to interview our guest, and he's going to share with us in an interview with Mike Yarger and Tina, myself, about the Las Vegas shooting. And I'd like to say at first, we're very saddened by the events, and our thoughts and prayers go out to the families, the victims, and everyone involved. We're very grateful for the leadership that people in the crowd showed, that our blue lives did to respond, our red lives, the firemen, everybody shows the humanity that we do have in an event like that. But we would like to know and have a professional opinion on the Vegas shooting. So if you would, we'll start with Mike.
Okay. So with the Vegas shooting, it seems like the ability to fire that weapon rapidly came down to something called a bump stock, right? And we're all hearing about this in the news, but I think very few of us have any clue what the heck a bump stop is. I don't think I've ever heard the word prior to this week.
I hadn't.
Can you enlighten us, Keith?
Well, you know, a bump stock is a pretty simple feature that basically replaces the stock of typically it's on an AR-15 platform, which could be, you know, a lot of different types of weapons, but typically the .223 caliber AR-15 platform is what this is designed for. They're readily available. I've used them before. They do simulate rapid fire or automatic gunfire, and as we have seen in the news, tragically, it is a deadly accessory that easily found on the internet and purchased by just about anybody, configured easily onto the weapon, and obviously has a deadly you know, capabilities as far as the amount of rounds that can be fired. You know, if it's anywhere from 400 to 800 rounds per minute, depending on how many magazines you've got ready to go, and it does a lot of you know, horrific damage.
Now, Keith, is this something that's used professionally, too? So do police forces, military, things like this use it, or is this just kind of off-market for, you know, personal use?
No, the latter. It's okay. Definitely not something that is used by law enforcement or military. This is something it's more of a, you know, I don't know what the original design intent was by the manufacturers, but it's more of a gimmick. I would say for people that go out on the range and want to simulate fully automatic gunfire and get a laugh out of it. Unfortunately, what we've seen in the past week is how very deadly serious something like this is when it's added to a weapon such as an AR-15.
Another interesting thing to note is the NRA just came out recently and kind of sided with folks that wanted gun control, at least for bump stocks, and saying, you know what, maybe these aren't appropriate. So what are your thoughts on that, Keith?
No, I think everybody's kind of on the same platform. I think even the president and the White House have kind of hinted that this is something that sort of crosses over the line. There's really, you know, no legitimate reason to put something like this on there. I mean, the military certainly has fully automatic weapons. SWAT teams and certain law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, have automatic weapons, double tap, fully automatic, what have you. So there's no reason to have a bump stock, which, to answer Mike's question, really, in the way it simulates, it actually moves back and forth. The rear stock, when you replace your standard stock with a bump stock, it basically moves, you know, I'll say a half inch back and forth. And I may have the dimensions wrong. I'm just going by memory and actually having used one and seen it. And then as you fire the weapon, you push forward, which is sort of an unnatural act for people that are used to tucking it into their shoulder. But you push forward on the weapon, and it continues to fire. And basically, it's allowing the trigger, which is in semi-automatic mode, to fire very rapidly, faster than your sympathetic reflex on your finger can pull the trigger. So that's essentially how it works. But in the normal ranks of law enforcement, military, security, and I would say even lawful gun owners, this is something that, you know, there really isn't a legitimate reason to have it, other than for, like I say, if it's something of a novelty, where you go out to the range and you go through, you know, three or four magazines and realize that this is allowing you to fire very rapidly but not very accurately, with the exception of, and we can talk about, you know, the circumstances of the elevated shooter with 20,000 people below you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's correct. You know, something like that is not good for target control. There's no use for automatic gunfire except for what he did with it. You know, automatic gunfire continues to rise, so you would not hit as many targets, except in his situation, how he used it. Military has actually backed off on automatic gunfire for the regular Marine or soldier and gone to a three-round burst. So automatic fire is for, you know, to suppress the enemy, to lay down a field of fire. Certainly not anything that we would need the bump stock.
I hadn't heard of bump stocks before this. So, I mean, forgive my ignorance. Has something like this been used in mass shootings in the past?
I thought it was a bad investment. Bump
stocks. Yeah, I think bump stocks.
Yeah, interestingly, I to answer Tina's question, this is the first shooting I've ever heard of where a bump stock was used. And it was mentioned on the news, but it does require some getting used to and some training. I mean, you can't just go fire this like you would normally fire your normal shoulder, you know, your shoulder mount rifle or AR. This is something you need to kind of figure out the unnatural act of pushing forward and getting that sort of ratcheting effect going back and forth, which you know, takes some getting used to on the range. And as Mike said, you know, the accuracy once you get beyond a three-round burst is exponentially goes off the paper, so to speak, on your target. So even in the FBI, when, you know, I was a firearms instructor, defensive tactics instructor, they issued us, you know, MP5s, and I also had an M16, but even the M16 had a burst mode in it to prevent from going into full auto mode. So even the full auto mode is really not a very useful for law enforcement or for military, and as Tim mentioned, other than maybe to intimidate the enemy. But we certainly have no reason for this type of mechanism on a firearm in the civilian population or here in the United States.
Okay, we also have with us today Mr. Tim Andrews, who is president of SCOPE.
Correct.
And SCOPE is New York statewide. And tell us a little bit more, real briefly, the depth of SCOPE.
SCOPE is basically a Second Amendment civil rights organization defending New Yorkers' civil gun rights in New York State. I guess to put it on comparison, we're comparable to, say, the NRA only on a national level. We're a state organization that does pretty much the same thing. We focus on the state legislature and electing pro-gun candidates in New York State.
And your position with SCOPE, sir?
I'm president of SCOPE.
Great. Right. Okay, so the show's already in progress, so we want to go with the flow. Now, we've discussed the bump stock from law enforcement angle and people who are just curious. And so what would you say about the NRA conceding to getting rid of the bump stock?
I'm rather surprised that they're jumping so quick at that. I think we need to look at the big picture. The thing with any type of legislation regarding firearms, or legislation, or in this case, a bureaucratic decision on firearms. The problem with anything like that is it seems to take the focus away from looking at the real crux of the issue. And I think there's issues here that go far beyond, I think, terrorism in general, and that's what this was, an act of terrorism, is far deeper than the tool that's being used. I mean, we've seen terrorism where sarin gas was used in Japan 20 years ago. You've got situations where vehicles are used. There's a deeper problem there that we need to look at. I think it's much too soon. I mean, most people didn't know what a bump stock was until this week, you know, what it even was. Most people will tell you they're not a very efficient thing to use in terms of ammunition. And once you get a lot of money to spend on ammunition, they can be very expensive. They're not very accurate. I'm not so quick to look at a bureaucratic solution to a situation like this as the NRA is. I think it's something we have to look at deeper. I think that we have to be aware of knee-jerk reactions to situations like this.
Okay. Now let's go on about the Las Vegas shooting. Mike, did you have a question, or we just really want to get Mr. Kutry's and Mr. Andrews' opinion?
Right. I think the bump stock is really the low-hanging fruit on the tree, right? I mean, that's an easy one to say, okay, this is something that really isn't necessary, and, you know, it's an easy thing to ban, but it really doesn't answer any, you know, real, doesn't give us any answers to the crises that we're facing here time and again. So, what more do you think we could do?
Well, I definitely think that one of the real counterproductive things we tend to do is whenever there's something like this, our first thought is what can we ban? What can we do? And I think what's interesting, coming from the anti-gunners on this issue, is we're beginning to see what we felt has been the truth all along, is that our ultimate goal is to ban things. Just yesterday, Nancy Pelosi, when asked about banning bump stocks, said, well, you know, there's a fear if we ban bump stocks, something that's going to lead to more gun legislation. Her response was, yeah, or she hopes so. And then, of course, now you finally got a New York Times editorial writer who wrote the other day about banning the Second Amendment. So I think the good thing about that is we're finally hearing the truth. We're finally hearing from them what they really want to do, because up to this point, they haven't been telling us that. Most of us who've been around this long enough know that that's where they ultimately want to go, but they've always been reluctant to bring that out. Now they're coming out with it. And I'd be happy to have a debate on whether or not we should ban the Second Amendment or repeal the Second Amendment. I think that would be an honest debate, and Americans would truly have an idea where gun banners really want to go.
Who would be your opponent locally?
Locally? Well, you've got Louise Slaughter is probably the biggest one. And,
wow.
She also happens to be my representative in Congress. And, there's no shortage of them here in New York State, obviously. So going from whether we're talking Louise Slaughter, Chuck Schumer,
right,
Kristen Gillibrand, or Andy Cuomo.
Okay, Mr. Kutry, give us your opinion on, not we've done enough on this part. How about the Las Vegas shooting, the shooter, the profile, things like that?
Right. So, I mean, as far as what the American people have been told so far through the media, through the press releases that the sheriff has held out there along with other officials, is that this shooter basically was under the radar. He did not have any overt mental health issues that became apparent either through his interactions with family or friends or his girlfriend. And again, going on the bits and pieces that we know today, we certainly aren't involved in the day-to-day investigation, and certainly that investigation continues. So we don't really have a good profile of the individual, but what we know at this point is shocking. It shocks the conscience that something an individual like this, to do what they did, there were no indicators of any sort of mental defect or tendencies towards violence or even a fantasy towards doing something like this. And, without getting into all the psychiatry around levels of dangerousness and criminality and those types of things, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people act out in this fashion. The typical one that we've seen over the last few years, obviously, is from what we see in what people call it religious reasons or, something greater than themselves, the things we've seen from in the Middle East, the terrorism acts, ISIS, they kind of latch on to a common belief. So that seems to be one that we've seen quite often. But underneath all those layers, there's something that's motivating the individual to sort of follow that mantra and go along with the ride, so to speak. But other issues are, people that are in desperation. They, who knows? I'm just making this up, but if the shooter lost his entire life savings in one fell swoop while he was betting the millions of dollars that apparently he would do on a yearly basis, maybe he just decided to go out in a blaze of glory. Maybe this was some sort of a fantasy. Maybe the guy was a gamer online and did lots of these combat games and videos that many people and kids today are interacting with online, and he acted out on his fantasy. Maybe this is something, a sexual fantasy. Believe it or not, that those tendencies do lead to some sort of violence in some cases. We just don't know. We don't know. And I think the law enforcement community out there obviously are doing all the things they should be doing. They've got their search warrants on the premises, vehicles, as well as hard drives and computer systems that he has or had access to, his personal computers, the devices that he carried as far as his cell phones and smartphones and those types of things. All that data needs to be collected and analyzed to determine, what was this person's state of mind outside of the normal daily activities that he was pursuing that apparently had no indication that he would be doing this.
What are your thoughts on the hotel security? Maybe even the people around the hotel, the people that were on the floor, the attendees, the people who serve the food. It's hard to understand 36, isn't it 36 rifles that, or 26, I don't know, that made it upstairs?
Right. So, I travel almost on a weekly basis, so I'm in and out of hotels both in North America and in Europe and around the world. So I realize that, security is really lax in hotels, but at the same side of the fence, you're talking about going to a place to have a room to go to sleep and do business with, and just like you would go to the grocery store. I mean, when's the last time you went through a magnetometer to go to Wegmans? You just don't think that you have to have that type of security and that type of a hardened entrance into a hotel room, or a hotel that, you're there to rest and recharge your batteries, do business, have dinner with clients, whatever it might be, or your family on vacation. It's just not something that I think we thought about. It's certainly being thought about now. As far as how did he get all these weapons in, I mean, we don't know. I'm not going to speculate. But the one thing that caught me a little bit by surprise, the sheriff out there in one of the press releases or the conferences with the press had indicated how could he have done this without help. And, I thought about that long and hard, and I don't see any reason why he needed help. You can easily you know, go in and out of those hotels. And he was considered, he wasn't considered what they call a whale in Las Vegas, a whale being a big, bigger than a shark, I guess, or you're
big spender, gets all the concierge.
You're more than a high roller. I think he was a couple notches down from that, from what I read and understand. But at the same sense, he was given the suite up above, whether or not it was a comp room that was adjoining, and he didn't have to pay for it due to his gambling in the casino. Who knows? But I do know that out in Vegas, they do treat high rollers and whales and the different types of heavy hitters that come in with big bucks with kid gloves. I mean, they're not going to bother them. If they decide to have a wild, extravagant party in their room and they're making lots of noise and some of the guests complain, it's my understanding that the hotel will try to move the other guests, but not disrupt what's, the fun that the high rollers are having. So I would say that he probably carried these weapons in by himself over a period of 4 days when he checked into that hotel room and easily did it by concealing them. These were, tactical weapons for the most part. You're not talking about, 24-inch barrels on a shotgun or 45-70s with octagonal barrels that,
That's right. Everything was low skill.
These are low scale. You could have, obviously with we talked about the bump stocks. The stocks can all be removed on those, and you can easily put them into duffel bags. However he did it, I think he probably did it by himself. He was a lone wolf and had this sort of secret fantasy playing out in his head. They say that he was looking at possible targets in Chicago as well as other locations. Who knows? And again, I think once they do a look at what he was searching on Google and what he was doing on the internet and the things that are on his hard drives and things that he saved, maybe games that he's played, subscriptions to magazines that he has online and hard copy, places that he went, purchases that he made, where has he been, what did he do in the last 6 months, that will start to piece together, I think, a lot of the blanks that we don't have as far as information right now.
Is there an overarching discussion that needs to be had now about the art and science of profiling? Because all we keep hearing, and to Keith's point, this isn't someone, that was a recluse, that experienced some traumatic event and is suddenly going out for revenge. I mean, this was a seemingly normal guy with a family and, he had wealth, he was doing okay for himself, and suddenly he does something like this. So does this kind of turn profiling on its head? Is there a different way that we need to look at that? Are there components outside of mental instability that was relevant, or family history? I know they said that his father was on the FBI most wanted list.
Bank robber.
Yeah. So, I mean, was there something genetic there? But how do you adjust for that? How do you control for that? I mean, is that something that the FBI or law enforcement looks at, the way that they profile folks?
Well, I think the short answer is, I don't know. That's a tough
answer.
But in reality, when you look at profiling, I look at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, which I had used them several times for various investigations that I was involved in. So, for example, a serial rape case that we had in northern Pennsylvania several years ago. I worked with the local police, the state police, and the chief of police in that community, where they had a series of rapes that were occurring after hours at night outside in their community, and it was obviously very concerning to them, being a small community. We used the Behavioral Science Unit, which is based out of Quantico, Virginia, at the time at the FBI Academy, and they bring in experts, law enforcement experts and behavioral science experts, from around the world, from different agencies, law enforcement agencies, and so on and so forth. And you go and you present the case and you say, okay, look, here's what's happened in our community. Here's the circumstances. Here's the evidence that we've collected so far. Here's the victim and the witness statements and so on and so forth. And then from there, they sort of huddle around a table and they basically discuss, who could be doing this. And, and in my case, they zeroed right in. This is most likely a white male in their mid-30s. Probably frequents bars at night, drinks heavily, may have some medical issues, and there were a bunch of other circumstances around that. And I tell you what, they were right on. When we made the arrest and did the search of the apartment, it was almost to the T as far as what they had told us, the profile from based on recidivism rates and these types of crimes. But Tina, the problem with my scenario is we already had an issue going on, and now we're trying to figure out the profile of who actually has done these criminal acts. What you're asking is, how do we do that ahead of time before we have the criminal acts? And with a population of, you know, 300-400 million in the United States, I don't have an answer for that. We don't implant chips into our heads and walk through archways that read our minds, certainly that would be far-fetched given our constitutional rights and rights to privacy. So really what I think it comes down to is, we've always said this, you see something, say something. And whether it's your kids, one of your children, your father, your mother, a friend, or you just happen to see something, you know, call 911. We've done that in Ontario County, with drunk driving. I think people that are following a car that's weaving or crossing the center line or, you know, some other erratic behavior, the 911 center gets these sick or intox calls quite frequently throughout the year. And that's a good thing. That alerts law enforcement that potentially something is amiss before there's an accident, before there's someone that is killed in a car accident, and so on and so forth. That type of thing, I think, is really one of the first things that we need to instill in our children as they're going through school and all the way up through, is responsibility, not only for your own actions, but responsibility for our way of life and our freedom and being able to look out for each other. And if someone is in trouble, whether it's a physical disability or a mental disability, and that is concerning someone beyond, you know, just the normal routine day of life things that we would normally be concerned about with individuals, that's something, you know, say something. You see something, you say something. And you alert authorities, or you alert a school teacher, or you alert your parents, or you alert some sort of a someone in a position that can take a harder look at what's going on. Now, in this case, would that have helped? Again, the investigation's still ongoing. Were there indications of some strange behavior at certain points that no one said anything about? Who knows? So it's hard to say, what the answer is on that.
There's reports of psychotic drugs that he was taking. There's reports of anti-political protesting. That probably won't come out in the news. But I wanted to get your opinion before we get off the subject. The security guard in the hallway, and I believe an hour before they breached the door into his room. What do you think of those two things?
Well, so obviously the hotel was alerted towards the chaos that was occurring on the 34th floor or the 36th floor, and security guard went to investigate. Unfortunately for him, he was shot, I believe, in the leg, and luckily he wasn't killed. The reports that I read that the shooter had cameras set up in the hallway, in the room, also through the peephole of the door, to see what was going on outside. So he set up his own surveillance network to sort of protect his activities that were going on so that he could not be interrupted. Well, he was interrupted. So I would say that security guard probably saved a lot of lives in the fact that I think it was some 10 or 11 minutes into the actual shooting when he was confronted by whether it was a knock on the door or the security guard yelling into the room, what have you. And at that point, the gunman then turned on the security guard, I guess firing something like 200 rounds.
That's right.
Through the walls, I'm sure, through the walls, through the doors, and then obviously striking that. So to your point on, you know, why did it take law enforcement another hour or whatever it might have been beyond that, my guess is it's an active shooter situation. Violence has occurred, dangerous situation. You just don't send in one or two or three police officers in that scenario. You're going to bring in, you know, your SWAT team. You're going to assemble, you know, the tools of the trade, so to speak, that are needed, and that takes time. You know, you just don't run into those situations. They were probably trying to get further intel on, you know, exactly which room this was. Is it multiple rooms? Are there more than one? Is there more than one shooter involved? Is this an ambush situation where if we send all our officers into that hallway now that the security guard's been shot, are we now going to find ourselves in harm's way and then render ourselves useless to the public, you know, safety? So I'm sure the command post that was rapidly set up would be going through all these things and trying to determine the best way to approach the problem at hand. Obviously, they didn't have a counter sniper, you know, at the venue. You know, looking forward, yeah. You've got two broken windows, and you see muzzle flash coming out of one window at a time. I think in the future you're probably, because we have snipers on yep. SWAT teams, federal agencies, and so on and so forth, as well as military. And that's gone back since the beginning of time, at least World War II, where it's pretty common to look for elevated shooters and snipers to be able to protect, you know, the rest of the troops. I think you're probably going to see that now in these types of situations.
I agree. Mr. Andrews, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think when you think of this terrible situation here that occurred in Vegas, one of the things he did, obviously, he put a lot of time into putting himself in a good tactical position. And what this tactical position means, he built himself some time. He had some time to do what he did. In fact, as far as the firearm that was used, if you've got enough time and you're shooting at a crowd of 20,000 people at their elbow to elbow down below you, you could do a lot of damage with a lever-action rifle. You could do someone that knows how to operate a bolt-action rifle could do an awful lot of damage in the amount of time that he had. And that's why I don't think the focus should be – I mean, sure, there should be some focus on perhaps the weapon that was used, but there needs to be focus on other things, like how do we prevent somebody from building a tactical position like that where they can do that much damage? Obviously, if he was on the ground, we wouldn't have seen anything to the extent that we've seen when he was shooting from a building. The other thing is, when we go back to the buttstock thing and the reaction to that, and do we need new gun laws and such, I would say this, that, you know, that's the danger of going down that road. We, for instance, we oftentimes create good tactical situations for someone who wants to commit a crime. And what am I talking about? I'm referring to things like high-capacity magazine bans. All that high-capacity magazine ban does is make sure people like you and I don't have one, because we're law-abiding citizens. We're not going to break the law. We're going to make sure here in New York we've got a 10-round magazine in our gun. Do you really think anybody who's bent on doing what this guy did in Vegas is going to worry about whether or not he has a 10-round magazine or an 18-round magazine? Of course he isn't. So to me, a law like that builds tactical advantage in for someone who wants to do something else. It puts the law-abiding person at disadvantage. If you remember, we had one ruling out of Buffalo court on the SAFE Act, because originally the SAFE Act required only 7 rounds in a magazine. Even the judge up there admitted, and he acknowledged, that that's crazy because it just gives an advantage to somebody who's got ill intent in mind, and that's all that does. The other thing is gun-free zones. Again, another area where we've built a tactical advantage to someone who wants to do harm to you, because if it's a gun-free zone, you and I are unlikely to carry our firearms in there. If the rule or the law is whatever, that you, okay, we'll leave the guns home and we'll inquire them in there. But someone who wants to do ill isn't going to worry about that. So that's what I mean by knee-jerk reactions to this buttstock issue, is that, hey, let's think this thing through a little more than that. My God, this just happened. Like I said, most people didn't know what these things were until a couple days ago. So let's put a little thought into this. And immediately, most of the stuff that ends up getting passed impacts people in this room, law-abiding people. Again, someone who's willing to stand up in a building and shoot down at people, which is the equivalent of shooting fish in a barrel, they could care less what gun laws you pass. So we need to put a little more thought into this. And that's why I think, immediately coming out and saying, look, let's learn more about the entire situation. Let's look at the big picture before we jump into something. We owe the people who were harmed there that.
Okay. Mr. Tim Andrews from Scope. Okay, Mike, let's bring it back to local.
Okay.
We certainly have our own problems here locally.
We sure do, and this week we really saw it. The Canandaigua Fire Department responded to a 2-alarm fire at the Camelot Square apartment complex on Saturday morning, September 30th, around 11 o'clock. The firefighters entered the apartment and knocked down the fire fairly quickly, but they discovered a body in the process. The Canandaigua Police Department is currently investigating with the assistance of the New York State and the Ontario County Sheriffs. Now, the body has been identified as 21-year-old Nicholas Bice. The incident is under investigation as a homicide arson, and police are asking anyone with information about the circumstances to call the detectives at 585-396-1000. 5035.
What I found to be further disturbing about this was I heard that Mr. Bice's mother had been killed in a homicide several years ago. So, you know, different circumstances certainly, but kind of interesting that this type of tragedy hits the same family twice.
Well, and apparently that was a murder by his father.
Is the father still incarcerated? Do we know?
He's not still incarcerated. He was sentenced to 3 years, I think served 2.5, and was let out, I believe, last April. So he's not currently incarcerated. But I don't know if he and his son have had any contact.
Sure.
You know, in recent times. He did, at one time, the family lived down on Phoenix Street here in Canandaigua. And then they moved down to Florida. Okay. On Wednesday, we had our second incident, and that was October 4th, and shortly after 4 p.m., a Canandaigua police officer was dispatched to the Pinnacle North Apartments on Lakeshore Drive to perform a wellness check on a tenant at the request of the Pinnacle North management. The tenant has been identified as 48-year-old parole officer Sandra Gardillo. The police officer was led into the apartment and was speaking with the tenant when a weapon was fired at the police officer, who returned fire. The investigation has been turned over to the New York State Police and the Ontario County Sheriff's. The Canandaigua police officer was not injured, but the tenant was struck and transported to Thompson Hospital, where she died from her injuries.
Mr. Kutry, on the first story, do you think the fire, right, there was a fire?
Right, arson.
Was used to cover up evidence? And on the second one, and of course, you know, you're only guessing, I guess, at some point. Not guessing, but you know what I mean. You weren't there. On the second one, could there have been an obvious way to have handled that, or do you think it was mishandled in any way? And I'm thinking everything happened right or wrong at the doorway.
So, okay, so I'll start with the first one. as far as the fire being started after we're alleging that a homicide occurred, that is a key indicator into the mind of the criminal or criminals that committed those acts. And not to digress too much, but many times the nature of fatal injuries, particularly in stabbings, where the throat is slit or something else is done to the body, those are also clues into the mind of the criminal and maybe perhaps the relationship that that person had with the other individual. Many times you slit the throat. Criminals will do that if they have an intimate relationship or know the person very well. Same thing goes with fire. I don't know how often in my career I've seen where, you know, you find a body in a vehicle and the vehicle's fully engulfed when the fire department gets there. There's something about individuals that think that murderers, that they can cover up, you know, key evidence and perhaps distinguish and get rid of the body altogether, which obviously that cannot happen under those circumstances. So I'm sure the police are looking at that. You know, tying that together and trying to determine the circumstances that led up to that. Most likely this person knew the victim, the person that committed the crimes, or persons. And I'm sure there's lots of other clues and evidence that the police are looking at. Obviously, from an eyewitness account, you're talking about an apartment complex up at Camelot, you know, and whether someone saw something or a vehicle that didn't belong there and so on and so forth. So I'm sure they're following up on all of that, but yeah, there would be some element to the investigation as to why an arson potentially was initiated there. Again, perhaps after a homicide was committed. And to your second question on the incident that occurred down at Pinnacle North, and again, none of us were there, and the investigation is still ongoing. But again, my understanding is that a check the welfare request was placed to the management of the building, and that was done, from my understanding, from the person's employer, which happened to be the New York State Parole Division. So whether the person didn't show up for work, whether the person missed a court hearing or some other, maybe they had to go do a surveillance on a parolee or they had to make an arrest. I have no idea. But obviously it was something important enough that they knew something was amiss and they were not able to contact that person either via cell phone or some other communication method. So once the management was notified, it's my understanding that they tried to contact the resident. They were unable to do that, so the police were called. Canandaigua police showed up. I don't know, if it was one officer, two officers, what it might have been initially. I'm assuming they knocked on the door, made contact somehow, whether the door was open or unlocked, and they could not make contact. They're privileged and authorized to be there on a check the welfare. Particularly under these circumstances, I'm sure they were told that it was a law enforcement officer and they missed something that was relevant and important enough that they need to check the welfare for a potential medical issue or some other issue. Who knows? There may have been mental health indicators. Perhaps the tenant made a phone call to somebody, that keyed them in. Again, what I said earlier, see something, say something, right? So once the police made entrance, again, I don't know the circumstances as far as what happened, but I can tell you under Article 35, if you're privileged and authorized to be there and someone points a gun at you, that is a justifiable reason to use your service weapon for defense of yourself and other officers that might be around you or other people that may have been in that apartment. Again, we just don't know all the details.
I think we talked about that before, but we can't do it now. But you brought up, I think, on our last interview that a great topic to talk about would be the self-defense levels of your rights as a gun owner. And Mr. Andrews can't do it today, mm-hmm. but someday that would be a great topic for both of you.
Right.
But Mike's got to run down the local news, so let's
Following these two incidents, the Canandaigua City Manager, John Goodwin, released the following statement, and I want to quote him on this. He said, "This week our community has experienced two incidents that we wish did not occur. The two incidents are the arson and homicide that occurred on Saturday and the shooting that occurred yesterday evening. Because these incidents are not commonplace, some in the community have expressed concern for their safety. Canandaigua was, is, and continues to be a safe community. There have also been some in the community that are concerned about the amount of information regarding both incidents that have been released. Both incidents were under active investigation with the goal of learning all the facts related. At no time do we want to release information that we do not have full confidence of in terms that the information be fact. We have very talented and skilled investigators from our police department, Ontario County Sheriffs, and the New York State Troopers working on these investigations. I thank the experts from both the state and the county for their assistance and continue to be impressed by the dedication of these investigators from all three agencies. I want to reiterate that Canandaigua is a safe community. Once it is appropriate to release more information about these incidents, we will provide that information to the public." And that's signed by John Goodwin, city manager.
I think it's easy for us to try to armchair quarterback this whole thing before all the information is released. And I'm disappointed in some folks in the community thinking they have a right to the information while there's an ongoing investigation. I think we have a right to public safety, and we have that because we do have people protecting us. They took care of the situation very quickly and appropriately. I think we just need to sit back and wait until the facts come out. It's not any community's right to know that up front. When the time is right, to Mr. Goodwin's point, we'll know. I don't think we need to question the New York State Police or the Canandaigua Police Department or anyone else involved in the investigation until they determine what's appropriate.
Somebody worded it on 2020 the best way, your need for instant gratification is not above other people's safety.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And right. We live in a world that allows that. And to Mike's Canandaigua 2020 page, you gained, I think, over 300 members after this Pinnacle North incident occurred. Did I take your thunder there?
No.
No, I mean, people are looking to venues like that to get news right away and to be able to comment and to provide input. But to your point, Tim, they also need to realize that that's not going to come at
all costs. There's three ways to get information in this town, and it's gossip. People, you were here Monday, and look what insight that gentleman wanted to share on the first case. And then I called someone we all know, and he had friends that had already been talking. And so, you know, your gossip or Facebook. And Facebook 2020 threw in stuff, you know, as it was happening. You get to know we had a guy trying to burglarize or hide from the cops last night. Well, we saw it on Facebook on the ward news before it even, you know, it would ever have hit the news, if it ever would have. So this inner social media and letting everybody know what's going on, it's good, but it can also be, you know, unfactual.
It's funny because that whole thread started out with somebody asking all kinds of cops going down Main Street, what's going on? You know, which is something that we all would be concerned about if we saw a whole bunch of police and fire vehicles and whatnot heading to a location. We'd all be curious as to, you know, why are so many of our law enforcement officers being called into this situation? And, yeah, the Canandaigua 2020 basically scooped everybody else because we have the eyes and ears of the community looking in. So we had people in the complex saying, hey, they're not letting me into this building. So now we know it's occurring at Pinnacle North, right? Okay. And we also had people who were speculating and saying, oh, well, I was told from one of the neighbors, you know, that there were two people shot and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of that information turned out to be false. But we also gained insight into the people who post that type of stuff, right? I mean, we know this is somebody that we probably don't want to trust the information that they're providing to us. So, you know, whether it's accurate or not accurate, you know, it gives us insight into the people who are providing the information. So I think social media is a great benefit, but also a potential curse.
No, absolutely.
So, yeah. So I wanted to move off from our crime discussion and into the next topic, which is our integrated pest management program here in Canandaigua. That was something that was passed by the City Council in 2010 and was developed by Cornell University to reduce the use of pesticides in our community while effectively managing our parks and playgrounds. Now, last year in 2016, the City Council, by a 5-4 vote and against the advice of our experts, implemented a 5-year ban on the use of pesticides in the city. As part of the ban, the Parks Department was required to report back to Council on the impact. When they did, Jim Sprague and Dick Gates reported to Council that the pesticide ban had been a complete failure. Some park fields have had to be closed, others are being taken over by clover, and the organic pesticides that they were asked to use are ineffective in controlling the spread of weeds. And in spite of these challenges, City Council has refused to lift the ban on the pesticide use. Moving on to our City Council meeting that occurred October 5th, the Council unanimously supported a Town of Canandaigua legislative request to share courtroom facilities. If approved, this move could save the town over $1 million in state-mandated upgrades to the current court facilities. And basically what's required is some approval from the state or some changes in legislation from the state to allow the city and the town to share the same courtroom facilities, because apparently town judges can't use city facilities or vice versa. But a legislative change could make that happen. The City Council also passed a resolution supporting and endorsing changes to the city charter recommended by the Charter Review Commission. Now, this is something that we as voters are going to have an opportunity to vote on in November. And there's going to be three questions on the ballot. And the first is, should City Council serve 4 years instead of two? The second one is, should city supervisors serve 4 years instead of two? And the third proposal basically fixes problems in the language and brings the charter into conformity with state law. So there's about 9 or 10 other issues that were considered minor issues that were asked to be addressed, and just to bring the charter up to date. And so those are covered under the third proposal. So the big questions are, should our city council members be elected every 4 years or every 2 years? And should our city supervisors be elected every 4 years or 2 years? Moving on to business news. DHD Ventures is doing business as Canandaigua Crossroads LLC, and they've submitted an application for a $1 million Restore New York grant to rehabilitate the Lavalon building at 10 Chapin Street. The amount of the grant is $1 million, but this project is going to be at least $10 million and requires significant environmental cleanup. So the $1 million is basically going to go to clean up the asbestos, clean up the toxins that are in the soil on the property, things of this nature. And these are things that DHD Ventures had nothing, you know, to do with causing it to be there. So I support this request for this grant because it will allow them to finally take this vacant property, and it's been vacant for a long time, a lot of years, and turn it into something. They're actually looking at a mixed-use property with retail on the first floor and residential above that.
Aren't they currently doing something over there now? I saw some fences
Right. They have some fences up. They have some new wood on, but basically what they've done right now is sealed off the building. Okay, and finally, the city of Nolens have submitted a grant request to the Office of Community Renewal for a community development block grant for $400,000. The rebuilding of Nolens is estimated to cost over $1 million, and it's planned to create 50 to 100 jobs. Okay, so again, this is a situation where I say, okay, this is money well spent because it's going to create jobs. And Nolens has been more than a restaurant in our community. It really has become an institution. And there's a lot of people who support Nolens, and I think this is a good use of state grant money.
They're having a big fundraiser at the Country Club. I think it's October 13th.
Right.
They're calling it the Nolens Stakeout, where they're going to have a Zac Brown cover band. It sounds like a great time, but, yeah, they're going to be raising funds there as well.
And not to interrupt, but Nick Violas's brother, Peter, and his wife were, I think, like 20 rows back from the stage at Las Vegas when that shooting occurred last week.
Wow.
So that tragedy did touch Canandaigua. So if that means anything to folks, at least to support Nolens and the efforts that they're trying to do to rebuild here locally, you know, I would encourage that.
Mm-hmm. And Tina, you got some other events for us?
Just a few. So one of the things that stuck out to me happening tonight is there's a live music series at the Upstairs Bistro at the New York Wine and Culinary Center. A couple of my favorite things, wine and live music. So that's going on tonight. Also tonight at Wood Library, there's going to be a Halloween-themed trivia night. Those of you who know me know that I'm a huge dork. I absolutely love Jeopardy, so trivia is also right up my alley. They're going to have wine and beer tastings, and it's $20 at the door. So that's over at Wood Library.
They're having that at the library?
I know. I was surprised.
Right?
I was surprised.
I'm surprised,
yeah,
too.
Me too.
But glad to hear it.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So both of those things are going on. And also, Finger Lakes Food Tours is going to be putting on guided food tours, pretty similar to the wine walks that we have. It's going to be in downtown Canandaigua, September 16th through November 25th, Friday and Saturday during that time. From 12 to 3, advanced ticket purchases are required, and it's $65 per person. But it's going to be tastings at local restaurants and some of the restaurateurs and chefs that are going to make some yummy things for all of us to try, I think. So $65 a person Fridays and Saturdays, September 16th and November 25th. So, yeah, and I know you guys are big on the square dance coming up, so anything you want to add for that?
We'll see you there, right?
Yep, sure. I think I got that thing, but, yeah, no, I mean, it does. It sounds like a great time. What's that, October 13th, I think, 7 to 9:30 at the Fire Hall, another town and city event. So, if anything, I think folks should come out and support the good work that the town board and city council are trying to do to bring things together.
Yep.
Okay. Mr. Keith Kutry. And I think this is brought up on 2020. How safe is our CMAC venue? And I can only give you 2 minutes.
Well, in general, I think our community is very safe. You know, looking at all the things that occur in the world and actually up in Rochester, New York, relatively speaking, Canandaigua was a safe community to live in and continue continues to be safe regardless of the unfortunate incidents that occurred recently. As far as CMAQ is concerned, I know all my buds over at the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office as well as the State Police. They do a wonderful job there as far as the security detail around the perimeter, the intel that they get from observation points as well as the traffic direction and maintaining peaceful gatherings there for large concerts and so on and so forth. They set up a command post. They have the three C's, command, control, and communication. They have sergeants that are there, lieutenants, and chain of command and all that kind of thing. So they've got that down to a science. And I think that is a relatively safe venue to go in. Weapons are not allowed inside. There's pretty good screening, I think, at the doors. There's always room for improvement on things, and I'm sure they'll ratchet down a few things probably come this summer, next season. And they learn every year from things that occur there. So, but all in all, I think we're in good hands with our local law enforcement.
The screening component, it's annoying at CMAQ to have to take your chair. You know, when you're going to sit on the lawn, they make you take your chair out of the bag when they're screening you, but I guess I never thought about it until we talked about Las Vegas a little bit earlier, what you could be bringing inside those chair bags. So I guess the annoyance is worth the additional 30 seconds to get through the gate.
Right. I think as a guy who did a lot of industrial security, I think eventually, currently, there will be a lot more watchtower type of security added to security. I want to get your thoughts real quick, Mr. Andrews from Scope. Just anything, just something you want to throw out there.
Well, the issue that was just brought up is interesting, screening people. And I mentioned earlier, gun zones. The problem I see with it, I'll relate a personal experience I had. We went to a movie one night in a movie theater in Rochester area. And I happened to be carrying that night. And there was a sign there. It said no firearms, so on and so forth, you know, in the venue. So I had left. Merlin at the time had said to me, why don't you just leave it in the car? No, I'm not going to leave a firearm in a car. We'll just go to the movies another time. So I left. Anyways, a couple weeks later, went back to the same theater. This time I made sure I didn't have my firearm with me. Went into the theater, but I made a point of watching security there to see what they were doing. What I concluded was I could have easily walked in there with my firearm. They weren't screening anybody. And nobody would have been the wiser had I walked in there and carried my firearm. Now, why that bothers me, again, it brings it back to law-abiding citizens. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I see a sign. I respected that. I didn't go in. Okay, someone who's up to no good is going to notice the same thing I did, going to walk in that theater and know that he's got a bunch of innocent people there, probably most of them unarmed, just like we've seen in Colorado. So screening. In my view, if you are going to, a private venue, like a movie theater, if you want to make it a no-gun zone, that's certainly your right to do that. But if you do it, you owe your customers the right to do some proper screening to make sure nobody is going in there with one, you know.
Closing 30 seconds, Mike.
Okay. I just want to tell people thank you for tuning in and turning on.
Tina?
No, I think it's been a rough week for Canandaigua and for our nation as a whole. But I think the safety here is no different than it was a week ago. It's just been a terrible rash of events and kind of an anomaly. So I love Canandaigua, and I still love the country. And again, I think it's just people. It's individuals. And at the end of the day, I think the good outweighs the bad, and we have to keep that in mind.
Keith?
I can't beat that. I fully agree with that. So I think everybody should, again, you see something, say something, carry on with your lives, and, freedom rings.
That's beautiful. Thank you, gentlemen and lady. I never know how to do it. I'm so not
used
to...
Why do we call it three men and a mic? I've never seen this third guy. Does he even exist?
He does. Ronnie will be here
okay. Someday. The mythical Ronnie Briggs. I've heard of him.
Thank you very much for being a guest on our show, and we hope nothing but peace and love for all of Canandaigua, Ontario County, and New York State, and the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Three men and a microphone. Tune in every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and check out our encore performance every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. Three men and a microphone is sponsored by the Military Exchange on Route 332 in Canandaigua, New York. Iron Mike's MX.com, tactical to practical.